It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Consider this. You feast on a chef's fabulous food, or you marvel at one teaching on the tube, but do you ever wonder what it took to learn all that? Our guest, the legendary Jacques Pepin, tells how he left home at 13 to apprentice 12 hours a day for no pay. His new memoir is The Apprentice, My Life in Food. While the Stearns are at the Gnawbone Food and Fuel in Indiana, professional taster David Rosengarten brings us the Catherine Zeta-Jones of canned tunas. Then our cheese guy Steve Jenkins riffs on the misbegotten mozzarella. And master theorist James Peterson talks the three things every rookie cook should know. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Underneath a tree, was out cold by the roadside, but only sleeping, don't you see? So they check my liver and they check my blood and all kind of tests to see what I've done. Call a doctor, intern, a specialist too. Say we don't know what's wrong with you. What's my problem?
Too much barbecue.
Oh, no, no way. What's my problem, man?
Too much barbecue.
Ah, you got to be bullshit. I mean, what's my real problem, man?
Too much barbecue.
No, no way. I mean, now, what's my problem?
Too much barbecue.
Uh-huh. And I was born with a rib tip. Just sitting in my hand, dog. And I was eating whole chickens before I was age 10. Woo! Mama told me, Papa told me too. Now if you don't quit eating, son, might be the death of you. Oh, I don't be a no chicken. And I get to ride in my Scoopy Bill. Have a glass of biscuits and a chocolate. Red line of ice trays are mounted on the face. The stereo speakers all over the place. 16 cheeseburgers we got sitting in a sack. About a half pound cheesecake. Now when I get through with that, woo, might grab a hump, an alligator pie, slap it all on the grill now. Well, nothing broad or nothing fried. So they check my liver and they'll check my blood. Ran all kind of tests to see what I've done. Call the doctor, intern, a specialist too. Say we don't know what's wrong with you. What's my problem?
Too much barbecue.
I can't believe you're telling me this, man. Woo! Now what's my problem, huh?
Too much barbecue.
Get your hands out of my face, you're gonna have my coleslaw. What's my problem?
Too much barbecue.
Nah, no way. Let me hear it again. What's my problem?
Barbecue.
Ah, no.
talking to me? Are you talking to me?
Too much barbecue.
I ain't never had another nothing. I can't believe you telling me this. What, you talking to me?
Too much barbecue.
No, no way, not today. What's my problem, young man?
Too much barbecue.
No. Yeah, let me hear you. What's my problem?
Too much barbecue.
No way, not today. What's my problem?
Too much barbecue.
No, I ain't going for that at all. What's my real problem? Let me hear you.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today we talk with Jacques Pepin, the man who was a star chef long before the word was coined. Jacques tells us what it was like to apprentice in the old French restaurant system that had kids leaving home at 13. His new memoir is The Apprentice, My Life in Food. Well, the man who tastes nearly everything, David Rosengarten, raises the bar on canned tunas. Cheese expert Steve Jenkins talks mozzarella, the plastic, and the silken. Master theorist James Peterson reveals the three things every rookie cook should know. Then it's water buffaloes in that Mediterranean mecca, Vermont. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Hey, Jane, Michael, have you headed toward the center of the country at all?
Yeah, we've been in the southern Midwest. In fact, Lynn, we went back to a place that was one of the first places Michael and I ever found when we were doing the original Road Food. It's got a wonderful name. It's Gnawbone, Indiana. it sounds like something like from a little Abner cartoon or something that somebody made up. But I remember back in 1974 when we first started researching Road Food, we found Uncertain, Texas, and Gnawbone, Indiana. And
as well as Enigma, Georgia.
And Enigma, Georgia, all on the same trip. But we hadn't been back to Gnawbone in, 20-something years. And I have to say, it's exactly as it was 25 years ago.
Not quite exactly, because when we were there 25 years ago, we found a restaurant called Brown County Tack and Snack, which was a combination equestrian equipment store and restaurant. It is now, basically the same place, but it is now called Brown County Food and Fuel. They no longer carry tack, but they do have gas as well as bait for your fishing needs.
As well as the food thing that reigns supreme in this area, which is a giant fried pork tenderloin on a hamburger bun. And the whole thing with tenderloins is not only are they judged on taste, but they're judged on their enormous size. They're hammered like a wiener schnitzel to be very huge and sort of free form, I would almost say a foot and a half in width, and then they're deep fried and served on a hamburger bun. Now, by the time you actually eat your way to the hamburger bun, you've eaten, three quarters of the tenderloin, and the bun is really there just kind of like a little napkin to help you hold the thing.
Well, in fact, it's kind of a problem, because if you go to Gnawbone Food and Fuel and get one of these, it is presented on a plate, and unless you have really long fingers, it's almost impossible to actually pick this sandwich up because the tenderloin goes so far beyond the bun, you can't reach the bun.
Can we call this Indiana cuisine? This tenderloin?
Southern Indiana cuisine. They're known in this part of Indiana for three things: pork tenderloins, turtle soup, and persimmon pudding. And in fact, when we were at the Gnawbone Food and Fuel, they did have persimmon pudding, which was kind of odd tasting because it was almost like a cake. It was sort of cut in squares like brownies, but it had this very distinct persimmon flavor, and they were selling persimmons at the roadside stands all around Gnawbone.
But to get back to your question, is this Indiana food? I think we're going to get strung up by people in southern Illinois and Iowa if we say that the tenderloin is unique to Indiana. In fact, they do claim to have invented it over in Huntington, Indiana. However, tenderloins are really popular throughout the lower central Midwest.
Okay, so we've got Gnawbone, Indiana. See, one of the reasons I asked about the Midwest was everybody's going to be crisscrossing the country this summer. I'm betting nobody's going to be going anywhere else. So this is great. Okay, tenderloin sandwiches. Thanks.
And you get a T-shirt that says Gnawbone Food and Fuel. So what's better than that?
Oh, this really completes the package.
I know.
Take care, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA. Now, they meet with us every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Now, every week there's a new recipe for a quick worknight supper, tips on techniques, what to check out in the market. This week, for instance, it is a supper salad. It's beans and greens with a great dressing. It comes from Sally Schneider. She's the author of A New Way to Cook. Now, you can get all the information on the website. The newsletter's free, so just go to splendidtable.org. Let all those foodies lug home from Europe their truffle oil and their cheese and their chocolates. Not me. My one great regret is that I have not been able to bring home tastes of every single canned tuna in existence. Well, enter our man with the golden palate, David Rosengarten. David does a food and wine newsletter, the Rosengarten Report, where he tastes sometimes over 100 examples of a food. And guess what? He's working tuna. We have caught him, well, you could say mid-taste. David, welcome.
Midstream. I'm swimming with the tunas.
Okay, David, talk tuna to me. What do you think makes a great tuna?
Do you think, Lynn, do you agree with me that the tuna in the supermarket seems to have gone downhill somewhat? You know, like 20 years ago, it was firm, it was really fresh tasting, and now I open up a can and I usually get these little floaty things in there, and it just doesn't seem as compact and good tasting as it used to. So a lot of foodies have turned to, it is more expensive, but a lot of foodies have turned to the higher-priced European imports. These things are usually packed in olive oil. And you get in these things the kind of old-fashioned flavor, firmness, compactness, lack of fishiness that you used to get in the supermarket tuna. And these are the very ones that I'm tasting today, Lynn.
Well, they're like eating steak. I mean, that's how good they can be, at least ones I've found. Okay, but what have you found? What have you found that you like?
In the tuna from Europe, and you get a lot of cans of tuna from Spain, from Italy, there are some from France, and other places too, like Portugal. But the premium grade, without question, is what they call ventresca. And it's basically like sushi bar toro. It's belly tuna. It's the fattiest, richest, most wonderful tuna. And they do it up, you know, like tuna in cans in olive oil. That is the thing to look for. Now, it often costs, you know, $8, $9, $10, $11, $12 a jar for this stuff. So it's definitely more than the supermarket. But man, is it worth it? Creamy, fatty, resilient at the same time, buttery tasting. It's absolutely wonderful stuff.
Okay. Well, do you have a brand you like? Have you found one that's a favorite yet?
Yeah, I did, as a matter of fact. So far, the winner is a brand called Albo, A-L-B-O, which I purchased in California a couple of weeks ago.
And that one's around in the specialty stores.
Well, that's where I got it, at a specialty store. You may be able to find that elsewhere. With a little wider distribution and one category down from the Ventresca is the stuff that is just, you know, like it looks like, it often looks like a tuna can, supermarket tuna can,
right.
Compact tuna in the can, packed in olive oil. And a brand that has come up very big in my tasting is Ortiz, O-R-T-I-Z. It's from Spain, and it's fairly widely available in gourmet shops.
Okay, and that's not the Ventresca or the belly, but that's sort of meat from the other part of the tuna?
Correct.
Okay.
Now, there is one more category that's really important to talk about because this is a new American thing. You have got artisan producers all over the Pacific Northwest who are catching tuna and putting it in cans. Sometimes the fishermen themselves are canning the tuna, and they're not putting in any oil. They're not even putting in any water. They're just cooking the tuna in that can, in its own juices. And it is making, in some cases, incredible tuna. This is really something new that people need to know about.
And brand names? Have you got brand names?
So far for me, the best one is a company in Brookings, Oregon, called the Great American Smokehouse and Seafood Company. And their can of deluxe albacore tuna, which costs $4.95 for 7.5 ounces, had big firm chunks, but lovely fall apart tender as you chew them, because sometimes those big chunks are dry. A great fresh taste, much fresher than most canned tuna. And Lynn, it made the most amazing tuna salad that I've ever tasted, because let's face it, that's how we usually use this stuff.
But see, that's what I was going to ask you, because I mean, the really great tunas I eat with a fork, maybe with a spot of lemon juice, also because they're pricey. I feel I want to focus. But
right.
I wanted to know, I mean, is it an insult to put these tunas in a tuna salad? And what do you think is the best one for a tuna salad?
I would not take Ventresca and put it in a tuna salad. Now, that's a perfect tuna for just by itself, as you say, a little lemon, little olive oil, little salt. Or, you know, in a salad niçoise, Ventresca is great. That's where you want it to stand apart.
Right.
But if you're making tuna salad, I would say the very best tunas are those that are white meat, usually albacore tuna, very compact, very firm, medium salt, not too salty, not too low in salt.
Right.
And this Great American Smokehouse deluxe albacore tuna from Oregon, I tell you, is it. You couldn't do better than that in tuna salad.
Okay. Well, when you think about it, $4.95 for heaven, that's really not unreasonable. David, thank you.
I'm going to go back to swimming.
Food and wine expert David Rosengarten is creator of the Rosengarten Report. You can find his tuna picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, I've got just a few more ideas for those tunas packed in olive oil. One classic is beans and tuna. All you do is marinate some minced red onion and lemon juice, grind in black pepper, rinse and drain a can of cannellinis or chickpeas, and then you toss everything with the tuna and its oil. Then do pasta. Now, you take the tuna with its oil again, some sweet peppers, some basil, some cherry tomatoes, some onions, some olives. Add that to hot spaghetti. Now, the other thing I like to do is this sort of pâté. Puree the tuna with all of its oil. You fold in parsley and scallion and onion and some celery. And then if you're really feeling a little fanatical and a little patient, you can stuff cherry tomatoes with that. Otherwise, just pile it on bread or on cucumbers. Oh, and if you're heading to Italy, leave room in the suitcase for the cans. Coming up, the apprenticeship of Jacques Pepin, the last word on fresh mozzarella, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where you can have your cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com/supertarget. Long before the term star chef was coined, Jacques Pepin was a superstar. His TV career took off 20 years ago. His books have been bestsellers since the 80s. He's developed food concepts with leading physicians, trained professionals, consulted for the industry. In short, Jacques has done it all. But everything began for Jacques in his homeland, in France, and in the old, some say feudal, apprentice system. It is the training approach most professionals love to hate, yet it produced brilliance, and it gave us Jacques Pepin. His latest book is an autobiography, The Apprentice, My Life in the Kitchen. Jacques, it's good to have you back.
I'm so nice to be with you again.
Now, I understand that when it came to being an apprentice, in some families, sending a child off to be an apprentice was really a way of dealing with great hardship, that you couldn't afford to feed that child.
Right.
But this wasn't the case for you.
No, it wasn't the case, because when I went into apprenticeship in 1949, the war was over.
Uh-huh.
Although people don't realize that even though it was over in 45, we still had ticket until like the end of 1947.
Rationing, essentially.
Rationing, yes, for I think meat at least, sugar and stuff like this. But in 1949, I should have or I could have continued in school. I had really no problem in school, but I wanted to go into apprenticeship. And my mother was smart enough to say, okay, that's what you want to do, you go ahead. So she took me to Bourg-en-Bresse, to the Grand Hotel de l'Europe, which was a chef there, Paul Jauget, who had been to school with her. And that's where I started my apprenticeship, you know.
How old were you?
I was not quite 14.
13 years old.
Yeah.
13 years old. Can you create for us that moment when you first walked into that kitchen? You were with your mother and you had never seen a place like this?
Well, first it was kind of I was a bit embarrassed, certainly, because I was in short pants with long white socks, because my mother had never bought me long pants because I was too small. So my actually first long pants were the apprentice uniform type of pants, you know, the checkered pants.
Mm-hmm.
But the kitchen was gleaming, you know, tiled, the big stove in the middle, the excitement there, people running around. There were the parrot at the entrance. I still remember that, and that parrot, I share my apprenticeship with him. His name was Coco, you know, and he only knew one word. The word was chef, that's all he knew. So it was excitement, you know, and I remember seeing that kitchen, and I was ready to jump in, you know.
What does an apprentice do?
Well, it's very menial at that time, certainly less now, but, you know, from the cleaning of the floor, at that time, what I did also was taking care of the dog. The owner of the place had like 12, 14 dogs. And I would feed the dog plus a whole zoo he had upstairs. He had a couple of monkeys too. So, you know, I was doing the soup, leftover with the bread, with different type of thing to feed all of those animals, you know. But otherwise, a great deal of cleaning. One of the main occupation is the cleaning of the piano, the stove we call the piano, you know, and the cleaning of it because it was in steel and would get rusted, and particularly the handrail around where the chef wanted us to use sandpaper and make a lattice design on that thing, which was totally useless, but it's part of the discipline and part of the, like being in boot camp.
You know? Yeah, yeah. Now, how long were you an apprentice?
I'm still an apprentice, you know, 54 years later. It's true, you know, in our business, we're always apprentice. But the formal apprenticeship was 3 years. However, it depends where you go after. You know, if you go in place, even now, I mean, from a regular school, if you go to the best restaurant of New York, like Daniel or Jean-Georges,
uh-huh,
you start at the bottom again, and you pay almost nothing. And because either you pay in knowledge or you pay in money. And usually, if you're smart enough, you pick up the knowledge. So when I finished there, I work in so many different places. I was always going back to the bottom again. But eventually, it pays off, you know.
Now, you finished your apprenticeship, and then you ended up at from what I understand, was one of the greatest restaurants in the world. It was La Plaza Athénée in Paris, right?
Yes, at that time, I mean, it was considered one of the top, the palace, you know, so-called in Paris, and the restaurant. We were 48 in the kitchen. I think we were 320 employees. And we serve about 150, 180 people, you know. So
there were 48 cooks in the kitchen serving 150 to 200 people.
The ratio at that point was like 2.4 employees per customer, you know, in those places.
Talk to me about how that system worked in that kitchen.
That's what we call the brigade, you know. And it's just like in the army, you have a brigade. So you have the executive chef that we call Monsieur, you know. And then the second one, the sous chef, was l'aboyeur, the barker. He was the one who would bark the order, you know. And under this one, there is all of the chef de partie, the head of the department, starting with the saucier, which is considered the most important, the most sophisticated, and then poissonnier, the fish part, and then the meat and the grill, and then the garde-manger, the cold department, and the hors d'oeuvre, and the potager, which is the soup, and entremetier, the vegetable, and all that. So under all of those chefs de partie, who at that time were in their 30s, some in their 50s, then you had a first commis, you know, and then a second commis.
So they were like the assistants, the undercooks.
Yeah, and when you finish apprenticeship for 2 years, you probably would start at a third commis. And then after a year or so, move to a second commis. And the first commis position under the chef de partie, those guys were 25, 28, 30 years old already. You would be executive chef here already.
That's right. In this system, you would
be. Yes.
Now, you said, though, the unusual thing about this was that you, part of what you did in that kitchen was you had to rotate through every area through the sauces, and that you became very deep in knowledge.
It was a great training because you went to all of the different departments.
It's like having a PhD in everything.
Well, not quite, but close.
Well, Jacques Pepin, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chef Jacques Pepin is a dean at New York's French Culinary Institute. He has appeared in 13 PBS series and is author of The Apprentice, My Life in Food. Jacques left us with a favorite childhood recipe, his mother's eggs Jeannette. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. We just spoke to a chef about his beginnings. Now we meet with a chef in mid-stride. James Peterson is a master cook, writer, and teacher. He's done encyclopedic books on sauces, soups, fish. Now he's covering the entire kitchen. His latest is Essentials of Cooking, more than 250 core techniques and recipes. It's sort of a kitchen companion. James, good to have you back.
Lynn, it's great to be back.
Well, you know, with all the work you've done on breaking down cooking into sort of logical processes, what do you think the rookie cook, the real beginner, needs to know? Like three prime things that are going to really help.
Well, there are a couple stumbling points for people that they often screw up, and they're very fundamental things. And one example is people are always asking me how to roast a chicken, what temperature to roast a chicken at. And I say, well, there's no point in trying to get an exact temperature because half the ovens aren't accurate anyway. So what I suggest doing is browning the chicken in a very hot oven and then turning the oven down low enough so the chicken continues to cook without getting too brown. The formula behind this is the larger the thing you're roasting, the lower the heat. It sounds contradictory, but that's how it works. In other words, if you're roasting a quail, in order not to overcook it, you've got to cook it in an extremely hot oven to brown it fast enough without overcooking it.
Uh-huh. So this works for anything that you're roasting?
Yes.
Huh. Now, you do need a thermometer, right? A little instant reading thermometer just to check that it's getting along the way you want it to get along, right?
It's a good idea to have one. If you practice a little bit, you can tell by looking at it and by touching it. But I still recommend people get one of those instant read things you stick into the meat or whatever it is.
Okay, so we're talking about the smaller the piece. First, you brown it, high oven temperature, and get it brown. And then the smaller it is, the higher the temperature. The larger it is, the lower the temperature. So
exactly.
You might do a big hunk of pork might be 325, but this chicken that's hollow on the inside, so essentially it's kind of small, that might be at 400 degrees.
Yes, or even higher. I always opt starting higher because you can always turn the oven down once it's brown.
Right.
But if you don't let it brown, then you screwed up.
Okay, that's number one. What's the next thing?
Well, the other thing that I see people often confusing or being confused by is sautéing. And this is especially true when it comes to meat. And the example that comes to mind is when you're browning meat for a stew, what a lot of people do is they don't get their pan hot enough, they overcrowd the pan, and then they're perplexed when 5 minutes later they see the pieces of meat boiling in this scummy-looking juice. I know this happens because when I teach my classes, I get these nods of recognition. And what I suggest doing is making sure the meat is very dry and adding it to the preheated pan very, very few pieces at a time and wait till each one browns before adding more.
So you don't let the pieces touch, essentially.
Well, not initially. As you're cooking, you have to judge a little bit by eye because everyone's stove is different. If you have a really hot professional stove, this is less critical. But if you have a stove like mine, you need to approach it slowly, one at a time.
Okay. So get the pan hot, get the fat hot, and then get the meat in, and don't jam it in there.
Just start with a few pieces at a time.
All right. Number three.
Well, number three is the basic concept behind cooking vegetables. And the thing to understand is that root vegetables are cooked differently than green vegetables. Root vegetables are cooked in a way in a very small amount of liquid so that their natural juices, their natural sugars end up concentrated and hopefully, if all goes well, end up forming a glaze around the pieces of vegetables, say carrot or turnip, whatever. On the other hand, a green vegetable, you do not want to cook like that. You want to cook it very quickly and ideally with not covered. So the way I cook a green vegetable is I plunge it, say spinach, uh-huh. I plunge it into a pot of boiling salted water for about 15 seconds, just enough till it melts. Then drain it in a colander, rinse it off, and that's done.
Okay, so if it's green and it lives above the ground, okay.
Yes.
You want to cook it with a lot of liquid or you want to cook it in a way that it cooks very fast.
Yes.
And if it lives underneath the ground, not a lot of liquid so that you get all these lovely glazes and juices going.
Exactly. That's if you boil carrots, you're taking out all their flavor because sugar dissolves in water. So the water leaches out all their natural sugars and flavor.
Well, we now have a trinity of guidelines. Hey, thanks a lot.
Sure, Lynn.
James Peterson is author of The Essentials of Cooking, more than 250 core techniques and recipes. Steve Jenkins is a cheese authority with attitude. In his nearly 30 years of hunting down and selling artisan cheeses, he's developed opinions, strong ones. Stephen, good to see you again.
Oh, it's great to be with you again, Lynn.
Steve, what I would like you to do is, could you once and for all lay out the rules for fresh mozzarella?
Rules? I hate rules.
Okay, but now what I'm asking you about is not the chunks of the mozzarella, but those nice balls of mozzarella
sure.
that you can squeeze even. So,
well, that's the beauty of this conversation is that so many supermarkets across the country offer both. They offer the handmade variety that's got all of that appeal and all of that texture and all of that great, great milky lactic nuttiness to it. As opposed to the stuff that's cryovac, the difference is just immense. When you're pulling fresh curd by hand that you've scalded and you're making this pasta filata cheese, which means a spun paste cheese, you're turning it in on itself over and over and over again until you've stretched all those proteins to where they're at the perfect consistency and then turn that out where it's not even been refrigerated yet and is served warm. You begin to understand what all the fuss is about fresh mozzarella as opposed to the rubbery stuff that's in the dairy section. It's just an enormous difference.
But it's
the real handmade thing is like eating a glass of milk. It's just remarkable.
But, Steve, that's pretty hard to get. I mean, what I'm thinking about is in most markets these days, we have the balls of mozzarella. They are in liquid. It's often as close as we can get to something that was really made immediately. And in looking at those cheeses, what do you look for? What's your standard?
Well, first, you've got to make sure that it's as fresh as it can possibly be. It's got to have a tenderness as opposed to a rubberiness. That's first and foremost, because mozzarella is first and foremost about texture. And second, you've got to make sure that it's got enough butterfat in that original curd from which it was spun that when you slice it, the butterfat weeps out of it. And that's the real test, is that the mozzarella is filled with life, which is the butterfat content of the curd to begin with. And don't think under any circumstances that mozzarella is anything but a diet cheese, because it is. It's so soft and it's so filled with moisture and it contains so little fat that it's the paramount diet cheese of all times.
Well, how do you like to use it? I mean, aside from the sliced tomatoes, the classic way of eating it, how do you like to eat it?
I like it best just on a plate, sliced thick, about a half inch slices that I then blanket with fresh ground black pepper and drizzle with some specific extra virgin olive oil and eat it with a knife and fork just like that with some crusty bread that's either toasted or just warm.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need leaves of basil. I don't need a tomatoes, though they certainly enhance the mozzarella experience. But if it's a great handmade fresh hunk of mozzarella that you've sliced by hand and peppered and anointed with some good olive oil, there's just nothing better.
Would you ever cook with this paragon of cheeses?
Oh, I'm constantly asked in the store, where's the mozzarella? And I say, well, you know, the factory stuff is over in the dairy case where the eggs are, but if you want to really have a great experience, go to the cheese department, and we've got fresh mozzarella delivered every single day. If you're going to cook with it, get the stuff that's unsalted. If you're going to appetize with it, if you're going to eat it, serve it with tomatoes and basil, then do get the salted. Now, salted mozzarella doesn't mean it's going to taste salty. It just means that it's going to have been brined so that the great nuttiness of the mozzarella comes through, as opposed to unsalted, which you use for cooking when you're making lasagna or some other dish that you want to incorporate melted mozzarella. That's when you use unsalted.
Mm-hmm.
There's smoked mozzarella, too, which is just divine. And very often, since it's against the law in most places to smoke mozzarella on the premises, they will use liquid smoke, which, believe it or not, is really a very worthy item. That stuff that comes in a little bottle. It's called liquid smoke. You'd think it would be horrible, chemical, intrusive. It's not. It's really a very good product.
Huh.
And smoked mozzarella is one of the few smoked cheeses that I'll allow around, because I really don't care that much for smoked cheese. But yeah, smoked mozzarella is really, really something.
Steve, thanks for the primer.
Pleasure.
Cheese expert Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins' Cheese Primer. You can find Steven behind the counters of Fairway Markets in New York City, but you can find his cheese picks on our website, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for the weekly trivia question. Here it is. What's the origin of the expression to give someone the raspberry? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. That number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the origin of the expression to give someone the raspberry? And the answer is rhyming slang. Now, rhyming slang is a local code that Londoners, East Enders, also known as Cockneys, developed to keep outsiders from understanding what was going on. The raspberry I'm talking about is a perfect example. I mean, you know what it is, right? It's that rude sound that imitates a certain bodily function. So why call it a raspberry? Well, it's the rhyming thing. The sound imitates the fart, which in turn rhymes with raspberry tart. Now, food plays big in rhyming slang. For instance, a Cockney would say, "Come down the apples and I'll stand you to a pig so that you can rabbit on about your strife." Translation: come down the stairs from apple and pears, and I'll stand you to a beer, pig's ear, so that you can talk from rabbit and pork about your wife, trouble and strife. And I think now they've got to keep me away from the wordsmith listserv. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got John waiting patiently. So, John, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I am originally Scottish and now living in the U.S., and from time to time, I host a single malt night at my home.
Oh,
what a great
idea.
Where we partake of the finest of Scottish single malts.
Uh-huh.
And usually we serve or sample 5 or 6 malts in an evening. And I'm always struggling to decide what type of appetizers. It's not a full meal. We really try to provide snacks for our guests. And I'm mm-hmm. struggling with finding the right combination of appetizers for the evening. Do I go sweet? Do I go savory? And if I go savory, do I go light savory, heavy savory, that type of thing?
What a great idea. I hope everybody sleeps over after this is done.
Absolutely. We only sample.
Yeah, the thing I'm thinking is, all right, the things you would want with single malt would be things that complement the scotch, not conflict with it. And you have that smokiness, of
right.
course. And then you've also got, to me, I can't explain it. I get almost, it's not sweet, but there is a freshness to the scotch. That reminds me of that natural sweetness you might get out of shrimp or something. But this is what I'm wondering. How about smoked trout?
I've tried smoked salmon, but I've never thought about smoked trout.
Well, you know, smoked trout is a little bit different than smoked salmon, aside from being a lot less expensive. And what you could do is you could bone it out, put it out for people, and then have on the side a bowl of whipped cream that you have flavored with grated onion. And
wow.
salt and pepper as a sauce, you see? And it could even have a little bit of grated lemon peel in it. And that is what you daub on top of the smoked salmon and the smoked trout. And the smoked trout could go on a cracker.
What a great idea.
Yeah, I think this would be gorgeous. And also, I just keep thinking of the fish you would find, you know, in the streams in Scotland. And it seems appropriate. The other thing that might work, it's one of my favorite things to do with fortified wines. And I'm just wondering, I buy whole almonds still in the skin. You know, they're not blanched. They're brown. And then I toss them with a little bit of olive oil and butter and coarse salt and basil, and I roast them in the oven. And they're really salty and nutty. And they have a really great flavor. And you can even serve those warm or do them ahead, but warm them in the oven.
Keep
before
them warm,
you...
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then the other thing that occurs to me for that clean, pure flavor you get out of that scotch, what I call a sweet flavor, new potatoes, you know, the small potatoes that tend to be very waxy,
yeah.
They're a red skin sometimes. I would do those. I would boil those and get little ones and have them And then I'd put on top of each one, or invite everybody to just smear them with a little bit of chive butter. Fresh chives that you have just thrown into your food processor with good sweet butter and a little salt. Because I think the fattiness and the sweetness and the simplicity of that is going to really complement the scotch.
Well, these are great ideas.
Yeah, I'm thinking, and now my mouth is watering and I want some of the scotch. But John, may it help you.
Thank you very much for your ideas. We'll definitely try at least a couple of them.
Okay, and do us a favor. Toast the splendid table while you're doing it.
We will indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Goodbye. This idea of matching things like alcohol, not wine, but scotch or bourbon to foods, I think it's great fun. I mean, we do a lot about wine. We don't do enough about this sort of thing. A little sip goes a long way. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Linda's calling. Linda, what is up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I am interested in knowing the difference between baking soda and baking powder. I am interested in making my own cake recipe, like a yellow cake recipe.
Right.
And whenever I follow recipes that are in a book, it seems like the cake always sinks in the middle, or, I don't know, it seems dry. And, like, I want something that's going to be light, sort of like a cake mix would be, but yet I want it made from scratch.
Mm-hmm. It depends on the formula of the cake, but this is basically the difference. Baking soda leavens things that contain acid. Now, the things that contain, not a lot of acid, but a mild amount of acid. So you're talking sour cream, buttermilk, would you believe chocolate and honey?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, some of the stuff you wouldn't quite, you know, you wouldn't quite imagine, but it's that honey, chocolate, brown sugar, for instance,
okay.
Molasses. Okay, so, and baking powder is the combination of baking soda, some cornstarch as a buffer, and then something containing acid, like cream of tartar. But that combination leavens things that don't have acid in them.
Okay.
And generally speaking, you use a half a teaspoon of baking soda per cup of flour in a recipe, if you've got acids in, you know, other ingredients, and you would use no more than one teaspoon of baking powder per cup of flour.
Okay.
But if you want to make up your own cake recipes, I'll tell you the real trick. You have to understand the chemical formula of the different kinds of cakes.
Okay.
And most people who create baking recipes work out all the mathematics before they ever go to the mixer or to the refrigerator. Now, there's a couple of books you want to look at. And by the way, once you get this under your belt, it gives you incredible power.
Okay.
It really does. One is Take a Look at Cookwise by Shirley Currier.
Okay.
The other book is The Cake Bible by Rose Levy Barenbaum. And any book you can get, I mean, some of the ones I have are really old and I don't think they're in print anymore, but there are books out there for professional bakers. And if you contact your local restaurant school and ask them what they use to train people in, you know, like Cake 101, you're going to find all those formulas, and it's all by weight.
Okay, and do you have to use cake flour?
It depends on the recipe.
Okay.
No, but I don't mean to be cute, but there's so many different kinds of cake. And generally, yeah, for your standard layer cake, you want cake flour.
All right.
But it's all these proportions. It's like, you know, the fat has to be the same weight as the sugar, which should be half of the weight of the flour.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of thing. But once you nail that,
all right,
then you're free.
Okay.
You'll never be tied to a recipe again.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you. You've opened a big door. This is a great question.
All right. Thank you very much.
You take care, Linda.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, Francie is on the line. So, Francie, what is up? What pressing
Lynn,
issue?
I'm having a terrible problem with salmon and steelhead. I live in the Pacific Northwest, and I catch and cook and eat a lot of these kinds of fishes, and I'm having a terrible time telling when the fish is done appropriately. I know what a done piece of salmon and steelhead tastes like and feels like in my mouth, but achieving that goal in my oven is an entirely different challenge.
Yeah.
I've taken to cooking these kinds of fish in parchment paper pouches.
Yep.
I think there's a French term for that.
Yeah, papillote, if
right.
I remember correctly. Right.
And so the problem is that in order to tell if the fish is done, I have to tear the pouch open, let all the wonderful steam out, poke the fish around a million times, and I end up with a pile of hash on my plate.
There is a general rule, and supposedly this applies across the board, whether you're grilling, you're roasting, or you're doing what you're doing, and that is 10 minutes to the inch. I've found it's 8 to 10 minutes to the inch, meaning if the fish is an inch thick, it is done between 8 and 10 minutes. Now, when you're doing the kind of cooking that you are doing, because often, you know, when it's not wrapped up, you can press it. And when you press it and you get just a little bit of firmness, generally it is done. You know, press it first when it's raw to know what raw means. And then as it cooks, that whole, all of the structure of the fish starts to firm up.
Right.
If you press it and it almost bounces back, you've got overcooked fish.
Right.
And usually what you want is something where it's moist in the center, but starting to completely cook through.
Yeah, I seem to be able to do that with chicken and beef okay, but for some reason the fish just eludes me. The press test doesn't work with me.
All right. I think if you start thinking 8 to 10 minutes to the inch, I think you're going to be in good shape.
Now, are we talking 325, 400? Really
well,
hot?
Normally, with what temperature are you doing your packets in?
Probably 375.
375. I think this would be fine. If the fish is stone cold when it goes into the papillote or into the paper, then figure 10.
Okay.
If the fish is, you know, almost closer to room temperature, then go to 8 to
that
10.
That makes a lot of sense because we pull these pieces of fish that we've filleted. That's the other problem, too, is that we do our own filleting, and so it's not like a fishmonger has created this beautifully even fillet, and so you're getting one half of the fish that's done well and the other half of the fish that's raw.
Yeah.
So,
but we're often
putting in really cold fish because they've just thawed from the freezer.
Well, I think then what you want to do is add a minute or two extra to it. And the other thing is check your oven temperature.
Right.
Stick an oven thermometer in there.
That's right.
Because I can't tell you, almost every oven in the United States is off.
Right.
And so what might be happening is you think you're cooking it in plenty of time and it's underdone because your oven isn't functioning properly. It's not you.
Yeah. I guess I need to get over the fact that it is conceivable for a nice big hefty piece of salmon to take 15 to 20 minutes to cook.
Absolutely it is. Absolutely. And if you want to try, there's a technique that John Rowley in Seattle told me about that is incredible when you're dealing with sides of salmon.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, you know, a fish isn't square. You know this. I mean, the tail is going to be more done than the thickest part of the fish. But the technique is you get a skillet very, very hot. And you put some oil in it.
Mm-hmm.
And you sear that hunk of salmon fast, brown it on the outside, and then
right.
you stick the whole thing in a 275 degree oven.
Right.
And it takes about 45 minutes.
Wow.
But the fish is unbelievable because it's lost none of its fat. It's cooked very, very slowly. And, you know, I use the test to know it's done. Sometimes I actually cut into it,
right.
you know, and I look. But the reality is I use the press test.
Right.
And when there's a little bit of give, I know I'm there.
Great.
But with your packets, 8 to 10 minutes, if it's stone cold, go for 12.
Okay.
Give it a shot.
Great.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
Cooking fish isn't easy. And it's a great question. So trust the press test, kids. Go for it. You remember Steve Jenkins earlier in the show was talking about buffalo milk mozzarella? Well, you know, with all the press this cheese gets, it's imported from Italy. I've been waiting for someone in the United States to discover that what works in a damp, hot area of Italy should be able to work in a similar climate here. Well, experiments are going on, and one dairy is now producing water buffalo milk yogurt. But its location isn't Florida or Louisiana. It is that Mediterranean mecca, Vermont. Now, David Muller is owner of Star Hill Farm. He makes yogurt from water buffalo milk. David, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
David, why water buffaloes in Vermont as opposed to perhaps a warmer climate?
Well, I guess I had to answer that question myself when I started doing it. The way I put it was, why not? I had spent about a year doing research on it, and what I discovered was that it's certainly common wisdom that water buffalo belong in hot, warm weather. But, in fact, there are substantial herds in places like Romania, Bulgaria, where the weather is much more temperate. And what my research uncovered was that there actually was a herd in Montana that seemed to be thriving So after, you know, as I say, about a year's worth of research, it seemed to me that these animals actually could tolerate the weather up here in Vermont.
But why did you choose water buffaloes?
I was actually looking around for a, I guess best to be described, a small avocational project.
Uh-huh.
And I started looking at some interesting agricultural thing to do that would be fun for me to do and also supportive of the state's mission for sustainable agriculture. And I, in a sense, sort of stumbled onto the water buffalo, realizing that it was an incredibly underutilized resource. There are about, I would say, about 160 million water buffalo outside the U.S., all part of a sort of a thriving milk-producing industry, and the U.S. only has about 5 or 6,000. So there was a sort of a disjoint there that seemed not to make any sense.
Mm-hmm. Are they nice animals? I know that's a silly question, but cows have this reputation of being very docile. What's a water buffalo like to milk, for instance?
Well, they're actually, the if you talk to most dairymen that have milked cows all their lives and then switch over to buffalo, generally the feeling is that they never go back to cows. The buffalo, actually, I know this, you know, probably is not a big leap, but they are much more intelligent than cows. And they, you can, when you walk into the barn, what you notice is they're immediately curious. They'll pick their heads up and they want to investigate who's there. And then when you step up next to them and start petting one of them, they'll all start coming over more like puppy dogs with the, you know, sort of pet me kind of attitude.
Well, now you've decided to do yogurt. Why yogurt?
Well, actually, we're going to be doing mozzarella also. When I originally thought the idea up, it was going to be strictly mozzarella. And I guess, you know, I was aware that actually Bulgaria is a where yogurt was invented, has a pretty thriving industry in buffalo yogurt. So I thought, well, let me give it a try. And I made some in my kitchen. And to my great surprise, even by my, you know, with no talent at all, it was unbelievably good. And so I started investigating that market, and what I realized was that it was a huge market also.
Is there a great difference between buffalo milk and what's in it in terms of nutrients compared to, let's say, cow milk or goat milk?
It's substantially different. You know, the it starts off with volume that a typical dairy cow may put out, say, 60 or 80 pounds of milk a day, and a water buffalo only puts out about maybe 12 or 15. So as a result, so that the calves can thrive, the milk is much richer. So whereas normal dairy milk may have 4% of butter fat in it, water buffalo milk has about 8%. But that, you know, is what adds to its, you know, delectable flavor.
Well, we'll be looking for the mozzarella. And you know, it's nice to know that a water buffalo is a nice animal.
They're very nice.
Hey, David, thanks for talking with
us. My pleasure.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
David Muller makes buffalo milk yogurt on his Star Hill Dairy Farm in Vermont. Now, for more information, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And remember, call us anytime. Number's 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this from Ogden Nash. The cow is of the bovine ilk. One end is moo, the other milk. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. You can find virtually everything you will ever need in life on our website. Well, it's so simple, so convenient. Now the address is splendidtable.org. And be sure to register for our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, our humble attempt to make your weeknight cooking a little easier. Register for it online at splendidtable.org. And by the way, it is free. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Judy Graham is our webmaster. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.